Further ado, let's give a warm welcome to John Clark and Francis Dupuy-Derry to the Marxist School of Sacramento.
So I don't have to talk into this?
I don't, right? I can just talk?
Okay.
Correct.
Okay. Before actually beginning, by the way, I did write half of this book. Half of it is a commentary on Ricoeur's philosophy and political theory. It's really the first collection of his most important political writings, with an introduction to his life to a certain extent, but mainly his thought. And if anybody's interested, last year this book came out, The Impossible Community, Realizing Communitarian Anarchism, which is my version of some of the same things that Ricoeur was doing 150 years ago or so. I also write under another name, Max Cafard, who's a much better writer than I am, and he does something called Surregionalism, and this came out year before last, Surregional Explorations from Charles H. Kerr, publisher in Chicago, which, by the way, was the first American publisher of Capital. If you look at their logo, subversive literature for the whole family since 1886. They do a lot of wobbly literature now, and also surrealism. So I'm really glad we're going to have a long period for discussion, because I'd really like to know what you would like to know. So I'll just throw out some ideas about who Élisée Reclus was, why I thought he was important enough to spend a few years translating his works. There's also another book called A Voyage to New Orleans, which is another translation of Reclus' text. And then writing a survey, a critical analysis of his thought. And then I'd also like to throw out a few ideas about what's living in Reclus' thought. You know, what can we think about today that's relevant in relation to his thought? So I hope I can do that in just a few minutes, and then maybe we can pursue things, particularly how this relates to the world today, for instance, the ecological crisis, the global social crisis, and questions of organization, particularly questions of community and political organization. I got interested in Reclus many years ago. I happened to be in the Loyola Library, which is where I was teaching until recently, and I found this little pamphlet. It was actually an excerpt from an old journal, a kind of geographical journal from the mid-19th century, and it was called, in French, it was Fragment d'un voyage à la Nouvelle-Orléans, which is Fragment of a Voyage to New Orleans. And I looked at it and read it and found out that it was an amazing text by a young geographer. At the time, he had not become a famous geographer, a young Frenchman, Élisée Reclus, who had become radicalized as a teenager. He and his brother, after the coup d'etat of Louis Napoleon, he and his brother decided to lead a march to the mairie in the little town of Orthez, where they lived, and start a revolt. And according to the legend, anyway, by the time they got to the mairie, the whole crowd that they had assembled had dissolved, and these two young guys were there as the ringleaders. So they decided to leave the country. They were advised to leave the country. And Reclus left France. He went to England and Ireland, worked as a farm worker and a dock worker. He decided then to cross the Atlantic and come to Louisiana, which he did in 1853. He spent 2.5 years in Louisiana, mainly as a tutor on a plantation, teaching the kids on the plantation. and at the same time learning about American capitalism and also American slavery and racism. He said he could not stand to be, he liked the people actually very much, but he couldn't stand to be in that kind of repressive environment after those 2.5 years. So he left again. He went to South America, to what was called New Granada, which is now called Colombia, and tried to start a kind of utopian community there. Didn't work. There was a sort of crooked person that was working with him who wrecked the project. So he went back to France. Just finished the story of his life, I suppose. He went back to France, began to write geographical works, monumental geographical works, several volume works to begin with. In 1871, something very big happened in France. A revolution broke out, and he was in Paris, and he served in the National Guard. His brother, Elie, as we were just talking about before, was the librarian of the National Library in Paris. And after the Paris Commune was crushed, as an important political figure and opponent of the regime, he was arrested and sentenced to banishment in New Caledonia, which was really a death sentence at that time because the conditions of political prisoners in New Caledonia was really terrible. So he would have probably have died. But he was already known as a geographer, so there was a movement of intellectuals around the world in his support. And he was put in 11 prisons before he was finally released, but he was sent to Switzerland in exile, which was a kind of ironic thing for the French government to do. Rather than send him to a probably certain death in the tropics, he was sent to Switzerland, and where he discovered the Jura Federation and political radicals such as Bakunin, and he quickly became a major figure in the European revolutionary movement. He began to write, well, he had already begun to write pamphlets, but he wrote important political text in that period. Also, while he was in Switzerland, he wrote a work called the New Universal Geography, which was the last attempt, or successful attempt in his case, by anyone to write a universal geography, that is, a geography of the entire Earth. It was 19 volumes, 16,000 pages. And it's one of the most monumental works in the history of geography. When he was writing that work, he had to restrain himself politically. It was published by one of the foremost French publishers, Hachette, which wanted an academic sort of work, the definitive work on geography. So he saved a lot of his more critical writing, and he late in his life, he wrote another 6-volume work called L'Homme et la Terre, which is Humanity and the Earth, which was his social geography of basically the history of the Earth and humanity. It's the story of the struggle between freedom and domination, the struggle for human self-realization and the flourishing of life on the planet. It's the story of all the forces that crush the freedom of human beings, the self-realization of human beings, and destroy the natural world. That's at least part of what the story is. It's a history. It's a geography. It's an anthropology. It's an ecological work, and that was sort of the culminating work of his life. If you'd like to know more about his life, we can go back to it. But that's a sort of brief summary. I came across really his first significant work, which was The Voyage to New Orleans, which was a quite beautiful work. And Camille Martin, who co-translated these texts with me, also co-translated The Voyage to New Orleans. I do recommend it. It's a beautiful work of nature writing and travel writing, but it's also a very incisive critique of American capitalism, slavery, racism, and the diseases of culture, we might say. So I guess the big questions are, however, What is there that is of value in the works of Élisée Reclus? And I'd say there are at least three things, just to be very brief, three things that are of huge importance. The first is that, in a sense, he was the first person ever to really write the Earth story. You know, people had done little bits and pieces of it. But maybe you can tell me if you know of anyone else who did it. He begins the story with the origin of the Earth, the beginnings of the planet, the evolution of life on Earth, the emergence of humanity, the history of tribal societies, the emergence of civilization. At the same time, this is the story of the emergence of systems of hierarchy and domination. It's the story of the human potentiality being realized at the same time that the human potentiality is being crushed by certain social forces. I think this has always been an important project, but it's particularly important for us today when we live in a world in which the Earth story is coming to a kind of culminating point. Through all the years that I've taught, I've always told my classes, there's only one thing that I tell every class, no matter, you know, I've taught a course on philosophy and film, basically David Lynch films is what it's about. I teach global ethics, environmental ethics, history of political theory, Asian philosophy. Doesn't matter what the course is. I mentioned this one thing. We're in the sixth great mass extinction of life on Earth. And one of the things that always surprised me is that most of the students said that they might have been through, you know, 13, 14, 15 years of education, and that was not part of their education. In a certain sense, it's the most important thing. If an extraterrestrial were sent to planet Earth to check on what's going on and bring the news back to the home planet, I think it would be pretty obvious what the news is, that, you know, that life has been around for a few billion years, and it's been highly developed for a few hundred million years. And in those last hundreds of millions of years, there have only been six times in the history of this planet where there has been a catastrophic collapse in biodiversity and number of species. I mean, that's the big news on the planet. It's the news we don't talk about. So I think the idea that our education as human beings should be above all, I think the friend of mine, Thomas Berry, who's a he died a number of years ago, kind of famous ecological thinker, said that the great educator is the natural world. You know, to what extent do we know the primary educator is the natural world? The primary educator is what appears when you see the world with open eyes, when you are awake. Well, education tends to put people to sleep, and they don't see that. We look at the little picture, we miss the big picture. Well, I mean, there were other people who did this. You know, I mean, Hegel did it. Hegel told us this story of something he called Geist, or spirit, that expresses itself as ideas, as history, and as nature. And the story of the Earth is the story of basically our species realizing its nature, you know, that spirit becomes self-conscious of itself, or conscious of itself. You know, in a sense, Marx told the same story. And in his case, it wasn't Geist, it was the proletariat becoming conscious of the fact that its alienated products were actually its own products. And other people have told the story in other ways. But the first person to tell it, in a sense, in a truly materialist way, and naturalist way, and historical way, was Élisée Reclus. And I would argue this is what should be most basic to our education. Where are we in that story right now? And then, of course, the second part of it is, why has the story gone so terribly bad? Because it's basically a very good story. It's the story of developing richness and diversity on this planet. It's the story of the development of consciousness and self-consciousness. It's the story of increasing natural beauty and beauty of culture and institutions and so forth. But forces have crushed that development. And Élisée Reclus was one, I think, really the first great figure to point out exactly what those forces are. And in the book, I have a chapter on the critique of domination. And that's what it's about. Reclus was extremely unusual among 19th century social theorists in that he didn't focus only on the two things that radical theorists tended to focus on, which are capitalism and the state. He spent a lot of time on capitalism and the state, and subdivisions of capitalism and the state. He had a critique of capitalism, a critique of the centralized state, a critique of bureaucracy, a critique of electoral politics. But he also, one of the things I mentioned is when he came to the United States, when he came to Louisiana, he experienced racism and racial oppression. He got very much involved in the anti-slavery movement, but he also continued to be involved in questions of racism after slavery. And in fact, he argued that for many black people, in many places in the United States, the conditions after slavery were in many ways worse than the conditions under slavery, because to become a commodity is one thing, but to become a valueless commodity, or a commodity of hardly any value at all, is an even worse thing. So he spent much of his life in a crusade against racism. When he went back to France, his brother said it was kind of inevitable. He ended up marrying a woman of African descent, and unfortunately she died a few years after that. But his life was very much focused on questions of ethnicity. Another aspect of his thought was that in his geographical writings, obviously he wasn't perfect. I can tell you all the bad stuff if you want to hear too. But he really in many ways overcame the prejudices of Eurocentrism. The Earth story, the human story, is not the story of superior Europeans conquering inferior non-Europeans. Before our translation, I suppose the best known work of Reclus was a little pamphlet called Evolution and Revolution. And he talks about change in the world, evolutionary and revolutionary changes, as phenomena which always have elements of progress and elements of regression. And one of the things he was interested in was the way in which every step in history has both the progressive and regressive dimensions. So what he looks at when he studies a culture is perhaps, you know, what did the culture gain by the spread of, you know, the Enlightenment and all those wonderful things? But on the other hand, what did we lose? For instance, the communitarian aspects of tribal societies. What did we lose in the so-called progress of history? So that was a very unusual aspect of his critique of domination for that time in history. Another thing that was quite unusual is his critique of patriarchy. He was a radical feminist. He was one of the few people in his day, and probably even today, who defended women, for instance, who killed their husbands because of abuse. He said basically all the demands of women are valid. He opposed traditional marriage. He thought it was a form of slavery and subordination of women. It was a quite amazing position for someone to take as early as the mid-19th century. And he also practiced it in his life. I'm trying to cover too much. he was also interested in the oppression of children. He wrote about education. He had a critique of authoritarian educational systems. So in his personal life, he practiced an egalitarianism which incorporated differences in ethnicity, difference in gender, differences in age. In many ways, he sounded like some of the most advanced thinkers of recent times. rather than a 19th century figure. Another one of the areas that's interested me a lot is the extent to which Reclus was an ecological figure. He was a radical ecologist and he was an animal rights activist. One of the few texts that people knew in English until recently was he had two essays on vegetarianism. One was called On Vegetarianism, and the other used to be translated as The Great Kinship. We translate it as The Extended Family. In fact, his original title was La Grande Famille, so it's closer to that translation, actually. I recommend that you read, you get this book if you want to read any of it. read his writings about animals, and also particularly read his critique of the kind of destruction that was taking place, the destruction of nature that was taking place in the 19th century under capitalism. One of the things that's kind of interesting is this is a graphic. I'm taking too long, am I? I know I only have 20 minutes.
There's a thing over there.
I don't know when we started.
We're half an hour into it. Well, yeah.
I'm a half hour into it?
I don't know when we started.
I think we started about 10 after, yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to wrap it up very quickly. And if you want to talk about this, well, there's one more thing I have to mention. But the imagery is quite interesting. And maybe we can talk about it later. There are two images that we reproduced. By the way, I love PM Press. Originally, this was published by another press in hardcover. It was ugly. They didn't do a good job on anything. And I was just so happy with the kind of attention that PM Press gave to this and that they did such a beautiful job, worthy of Reclus. So, I really deeply mean that. But let me just say one last thing. I actually wrote notes to try to keep myself on topic, which I haven't followed. But what do we do about all this? And we could discuss that, if you'd like, in the discussion period more. But there are three things that I think were very strong in Reclus. I mean, probably the best known thing about Reclus is that he was active in the First International. He thought that the First International was really a world historical event because it was the first time that the whole thing is about the Earth story and the human story. And this was a very momentous event that finally humanity is brought together internationally, globally, so that the people of all nations, all races, all ethnicities can be unified as workers, basically. So that's the first thing we could talk about. He was very active in the First International. Second would be the commune or the community. And he wrote extensively about the history of solidarity and cooperation and basically grassroots communism in the history of the world. And his works are amazing. I mean, his two major works were 20,000 pages, which is one reason why he's not better known, because you have to look through all this to find this information. That's why I wrote the introduction, to try to bring some of it together. But we're just beginning to catch up with that with the recent interest in the commons again. And this huge history that we have of cooperative endeavors and common ownership. And Reclus is a very important figure in keeping that tradition alive and really educating people about it. And the third is, just to finish it up with one more important idea, we talk a lot today about affinity groups, and he talked about small, loving associations, little republics, he called them, groups of friends. He thought we can't really change the world just by changing social structures. We have to change our lives. We have to change our mode of being. You know, if we're fighting against patriarchy, racism, capitalism, the state, etc., we're not going to succeed if we remain products of those systems of domination. So I think it's very important that we look at that aspect. It's the personal aspect, the psychological aspect, the obviously we talk about everyday life, but we could talk about practice, moment-to-moment practice, in which we transform ourselves through being part of a community of liberation and solidarity. And I think he's a very important figure in helping us go in that direction. So those are a few of the things that I think are really important about Aedes Iwerkiw. And he was born exactly 150 years before the first black bloc was founded.
Oh, nice segue. Thank you. You did not put us to sleep, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Well, thanks very much for inviting me here. I'm always a bit stressed out when I have to speak in English, because as you can hear, this is not my first language. So I'm supposed to talk to you about the Black Blocs. So a few words before starting my presentation, just to let you know that I have no specific knowledge about Black Blocs in the Bay Area or in California or in the region. So maybe you have things to say about it or thing to I can learn from you. So I'm not coming to explain to you what is going on here in the activist network or in the streets. And of course, I'm not talking on the behalf of any Black Blocs. That's impossible anyway. But just to make clear who I am someone who work on the Black Bloc, not from too far from them, but especially in Quebec, in Canada, in France, in Europe, a little bit in Boston, but that was a long time ago. I made observation about the Black Blocs in the streets, interviews, I read their communiques, manifestos, that's it. And as you know probably, so that's common sense, but the Black Bloc are these people wearing black clothes and masks, participating in protests in the streets. They are mainly self-proclaimed anarchists or at least anti-capitalists, often radical ecologists. They could be communists, they could be radical feminists. And most of the time they are part of protests in the streets and they are walking peacefully with other protesters, but only by being in the protest they believe that it will represent a radical criticism of capitalism or a world summit like the World Trade Organization or the G20 international summit. But of course when they provoke debates within activist networks and in the mainstream media, it's when they do direct action. So they can do two kinds of direct action, of course. Defensive, when they protect themselves or they protect the protests against the cops. So this is one thing they can do. Or when they are offensive, they will strike against symbol of capitalism, such as bank windows, or media vehicles, for instance, or they can, of course, attack directly the cops also. Although they are really well-known now, and they are known as being something really special in the anti-capitalist protest or the ultra-globalization protest, I think it's good to know that almost every social movement through history had their, I would say, violent elements. It's something we kind to forget in North America, I will say, because we believe we are living in a kind of a peaceful society and that peace protest is better, non-violent protest is better than violence in social movement. But of course, as you probably know, in the worker social movement history or the union movement, there have been a lot of violence on both sides, and even in the United States, of course, the indigenous activism have their own history of resisting with arms or direct action or sabotage or land occupation. Even the women movement in the United Kingdom at the beginning of the 20th century, the so-called suffragette, where were advocating direct action to bring attention to their claims, to their revendication, and sometimes they organized street protests which were pretty similar to what the Black Bloc is doing in many occasions at the beginning of the 20th century in downtown London. Hundreds of women just walk in the street smashing tens of windows of banks, newspapers against women's rights and other buildings, official buildings. And I would say that even in official history in North America, we are used to learn at school, for instance, about our own heroes and celebrate the official direct action, like the Boston Tea Party, for instance, in the United States, something really important, something really great for what we learn at school. But of course, we are not used to make links between these kind of official direct action and what is going on today. The Black Bloc is something really specific for several reasons. First of all, of course, there is this outfit, this black outfit. So some people will say what is really specific about the Black Bloc is not what they do, but how they look. And it's true. This way of organizing in protest, wearing black clothes and black mask, is coming from the subculture, European subculture, punk, I can say, and they are coming from West Germany during the Cold War. As John said, the first time people talk about Black Bloc was in West Berlin in 1980. It's not clear if it's the police or the people themselves or the media who started talking about the Black Bloc, coined the expression, but in 1980 in West Berlin there was this social movement called the Autonomen. Das Autonomen, I guess, in German. I don't speak German, but the Autonomen, so in reference to autonomia. There were people living in squats, political squats, and they were really involved into the anti-nuclear movement. They were fighting against neo-Nazis in the streets, and they were claiming to be autonomous with regard to the states, to the political parties, to capitalism and private property. This is why they were living in squats, and autonomous with regard to official institutions such as unions and medias, and also autonomous with regard to ideologies. So they were claiming not to be Marxist or anarchist or ecologist or feminist, although they were on the ultra left of the political spectrum. And from outside, we can say that they were something like libertarian Marxist or anarcho-communist or something like that. They do still exist, although the movement is really not as big as it was in the 80s. So the Black Bloc came from this specific movement, and the first time there were Black Bloc in protest was for protecting squats against police intervention to protect the squats from being evicted. And in West Berlin and in West Germany at the time in the 80s, you had a Black Bloc of sometime 1,000 or even more people in the Black Bloc. Then through the subculture music movement and the punk movement, the Black Bloc came to North America. The first time I believe that there was a Black Bloc in North America was in a protest for Abu Jamal in 1990, and then in a protest against the first war against Iraq. And the Black Bloc was also a tactic used by the anti-racist action network in the early 90s. In Montreal, from where I come, where I live, actually, the first Black Bloc I saw was in 93, actually, and that was people coming from Toronto. They were part of the anti-racist action collective in Toronto, and they were coming to protest against extreme right-wing positions from France, who were giving a lecture or something like that in Montreal. And then, of course, you had their day of fame in North America, which was in November 30 in Seattle. And I want to talk a little bit about what happened that day in Seattle, because I think it's really interesting with regard to the Black Bloc. First of all, for what I understand, is that that specific day, the mainstream media themselves gave a lot of publicity and exposure to Black Bloc, and I believe that the mainstream media themselves helped the Black Bloc as a tactic to get known by activists around the world. Although we had already, of course, anarchist websites like InfoShop and Indie Media, which were giving information about Black Bloc, but that specific day, the mainstream media helped the Black Bloc to be known. And the Black Bloc action in Seattle was really interesting because, as you probably know, they were the Direct Action Network, which was a radical organization, but using nonviolence, civil disobedience tactics, and they have been really successful in blocking the beginning of the conference of the World Trade Organization that specific morning. But what we remember or recall from this specific day is a mix of this nonviolent action, the police repression, and the Black Bloc. And it's usually, when you talk to people about Seattle, it's kind of mixed up what happened that day. But what happened that day really was that the Direct Action Network was so efficient that after a few hours, the police got the order to break down the nonviolence activist siege in the streets, and they used so many tear gas and pepper spray that they were running out of ammo at about 11 o'clock in the morning, and that was at the specific time that the Black Bloc stroke maybe 10 or 15 streets from the convention center. So there was two specific action that day: the Direct Action Network, which was nonviolent, and the Black Bloc, which targeted mainly capitalist symbols and smash windows. And then you had Black Bloc in the next years in Washington, in Prague, in Quebec, in Genoa, in Italy, and since then, almost every international summit was welcomed by Black Blocs. In the recent years, you had a Black Bloc in Vancouver for the Winter Olympic Game in 2010, then in Toronto in Canada again in June. It was the G20 summit in Occupy Oakland, for what I understand. And in Occupy Roma also, there was a huge Black Bloc in 2011. In the anti-cut movement in United Kingdom, in Brazil, Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro especially, in Egypt even, in Quebec during the student strike. Maybe you heard of the student strike in Quebec in 2012, and then again in the last couple of weeks in Montreal, we had Black Bloc in another student strike. I want to talk to you briefly about maybe two specific issues. Of course, in the book you have more information about the history of the Black Bloc and other issues such as the rationale of the people in the Black Bloc, why they do that, why they believe that it's a good idea where they are coming from, and other specific information about specific black blocs in Italy or elsewhere. But the two specific issues I want to talk to you about is the issue of inclusion and exclusion within the black bloc and within broader movement, like the ultra-globalization movement or Occupy or the student strike. And then I would like to say a few words about the debate between violence and nonviolence in social movement in North America. At least in Seattle, there have been a debate about the issue of inclusion within the black bloc. The debate about is the black bloc is only I would say a white angry young male thing, and you have no women in the black bloc or no people of color of the black bloc. And for what I saw, it is clear that some black bloc are almost made only of white young males. But I would say that through times, for what I saw, it will depend from countries, and it will depend from cities, and it will even depend from specific mobilization. On the East Coast, for instance, in Quebec and Toronto and maybe Boston, I'm not sure, but clearly in Quebec, 15 years ago, there was almost no woman on the front line in black blocs. The women were there, the women activists were there, but they were doing street medics, for instance, or scouting on bicycles, looking for cops, and with cell phones, letting people know where the cops were coming, for instance. But they were not on the front line, and in the debriefing meeting, they were complaining that they were not being taken seriously by the male activists who were proud of what they did on the front line. So there were a kind of a hierarchy between people participating in black blocs with regard to what they were doing or to what they did, and the male had a kind of advantage. They thought of themselves as doing more important and significant things in the black bloc. And but through the years, through the mobilization, what I saw on the East Coast is more and more women on the front line. And during the student strike, there were even affinity groups, women-only affinity groups in black blocs, and small women-only black blocs in Montreal in 2012. I saw the same thing in Brazil. In Sao Paulo, for instance, the black bloc is known to be mainly male and white, and in Rio it's known to be more diverse, more pluralist, more inclusive, if I can say. So it's why I'm thinking that it's important to look at the black bloc in its specific context to know if it's more inclusive or more exclusive. And and we can believe, of course, that it will make a difference the way it will. The inclusion of women, for instance, can make difference in the way it works within a black bloc. I will read a short quotation from an interview with a woman who is talking about this specific issue. She is a woman, just make sure, yeah, she's a woman who have been involved in mixed black blocs, so in black blocs with men and women, and in black blocs with women only. And she's talking now about the difference with women when you have to deal with only women in black bloc. We talk more and generally leave more room for living the moment. There are fewer preconceptions of what we aim to accomplish and more discussion of how to go about it. We stick together and there's much more communication when decisions are being made in the street. Men are more individualistic. They don't feel obliged to come back to the group and can talk off without warning. It's my top priority is me. I call them lone wolves, whereas women from form wolf packs. So this is an example of a woman in a black bloc thinking about this this issue of inclusion of and inclusion. Of course, also what I saw in the past 15 years is a more, I would say, a more efficient coordination between different kind of blocks. So you have the black block and you have the pink and silver block, or the with queers and people and the block of clowns also. In Scotland, for instance, in the protest against the G8 in 2005, and 15 years ago, at the beginning of the ultra-globalization movement, for instance, these blocs were thinking of themselves as not really allies, and they were a competition between blocs, or people were thinking, well, we have a better strategy than the others, and they were not trying to coordinate their action together. And through times, I think people learn to act together and to think of themselves as being part of the same movement and the same strategy. The best example, I guess, is this mobilization in Scotland against the G8 in 2005, where there was a huge mobilization of clowns, and there was people ready to organize themselves as a black bloc, and there was they were all staying in a activist temporary campsite. And the clown decided to spend the night in the wood and to wake up really early in the morning and to walk and block the highway going to the castle where there was the G8. And what the Black Bloc decided to do is what they call a Swiss march. They decided to leave the camp really early as a Black Bloc because they thought the cop will come to them, and then that will help the clown to do their specific action. And actually, it worked pretty well. So this is a good example of two different kind of tactic and two different kind of block working together. Which bring me to my second issue I wanted to talk to you briefly, was the issue of the debate of violence and nonviolence. And this is more brief comments. I guess you will have a lot of things to say, and we can talk about it together later. But maybe what I want to say is that, as I said earlier, I think in North America we as a society, we are really firmly convinced that violence is for social movement, because we are always at war against people in Iraq or in Syria or in Afghanistan, and that's good. But violence in for social movement in our context is something bad. It's morally bad. And it's politically bad. And it's also inefficient. This idea that smashing a window, for instance, it's something that will give a really bad image of a movement, and it will keep people from being sympathetic to our cause. And this is something that you will hear, of course, in the media. You will hear from the spokespeople of social movement and huge mobilization, and you will hear from people within the movement, rank and file people. It's giving bad publicity for the movement. And this specific issue of violence is raising other issues, I believe. For instance, claiming that we should get rid of the people using so-called violence in our movement is from the point of view of the Black Bloc, for instance, will be to acknowledge that someone owned the movement, that the movement is something homogeneous and that it's working like an army and that there is a leader and that the leader can tell the people what to do, what not to do, and what is good for the movement, and that someone can talk on the behalf of the entire movement. And this is something people in the Black Bloc will believe is problematic, especially in really heterogeneous movement like the alter-globalization movements, for instance, when in a few days of protest you will have the protest, the march of the union and NGOs, and then the march of the indigenous people and the women and feminist and queer protest, and then you have the Black Bloc. So it is technically it is an heterogeneous movement, and nobody can claim to be the spokesperson of all this movement, and so nobody can claim to know what is best for the movement and what the movement should do or should not do. So this is a the issue of violence actually is bringing other, I guess, politically more important issue. The other way to think about it is to find occasion or to find situation where nonviolent activists will claim publicly that they consider themselves to be the ally of the Black Bloc, or that they claim that the Black Bloc are their friends, if I can say. And this is something we saw in Seattle in 1999 from rank and files from the Union March, for instance. The spokespeople of the Union movement were really critical of the Black Bloc, but if you were listening to the rank and file, you will find several people who will say, actually, the Black Bloc and the kids were right. They were the people who did the right thing that day. But there is other examples. Indigenous spokespeople, for instance, during the Vancouver Olympic Game, were claiming that the struggle was bringing together radical indigenous activists in Vancouver and anarchists, and that the Black Bloc were their ally, and they were proud that they were there. You have the same thing in Italy. There is a campaign called No TAV. TAV is for a high-speed train. They are building a high-speed train railroad, and they have been. There is a popular mobilization against this project going on for the last 10 or 15 years, I think. And every summer there is activists coming to organize protests. And in these protests, you have Black Bloc and people there are they even have a slogan: "We are all Black Blocs," to express this idea that they feel ally with the Black Bloc. In Brazil, in the recent years, you had teacher unions who claimed that the Black Blocs were welcome in their protest and they would like to have more Black Bloc in front of their protest. In 2003, that was a long time ago, in Cancun, there was a protest against the World Trade Organization, and the during the main protest, there was an alliance between small farmers and the Black Bloc to attack the fence. And several anonymous protesters in different situations will say, well, when, at the beginning I was afraid of the people wearing black masks, and but then I got hit on the head by the cop or pepper sprayed, and who was standing there to help me? Well, that was a guy I don't know, but who was in the Black Bloc and who helped me with first aid stuff and stuff like that. So this is another example of way of thinking of this debate about violence and not violence, and not only bringing together this idea that it's not efficient or it's bad or it's immoral. And I guess this is why people at some point in the ultra-globalization movement started to talk about the respect of tactic diversity or the diversity of tactic. The idea that we don't know what is best, we don't know what is really efficient. We know that the situation is really terrible with regard to climate change and global capitalism and the state power and police repression. And the best we can do is to stick together and to try to be all together, non-violent, so-called violent, and the people in between. And it's together that we will be stronger. Thanks.